Welcome to this week's Third Opinion Podcast. This week, we will tell you a frightening story about Hitler Youth, and we'll wonder whether groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers could indoctrinate their kids with similar philosophies. People in Germany never thought that could happen there until Hitler took over. Then we'll talk to Ken Marcus of the Brandeis Center about President Biden's effort to combat anti-Semitism. And Laureen and I will get into it, whether the president should be praised or condemned. That and so much more. And don't forget, you can get your third opinion wherever you download your podcasts. And now, this week's Third Opinion Podcast. Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to us. This is the Third Opinion on WKDW in the podcast, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Thiessen.
Laureen Jaffe.
And I'm coming to you from Chicago today while Laureen is back in Tampa.
Yes.
Back in Florida, but the news is pervasive throughout the nation, especially when we're talking about anti-Semitism, unfortunately.
It sure is. Yeah. And I know we've got a great interview for the second half of the show with Ken Marcus, you know, to sort of walk through what the actual anti-Semitism plan does, which is great. And you know, as in Mike and I will talk about, because there are some criticisms of it and then some good things that come out of it. There was a lot going on this week, which was just wacko. I mean, for me, the first thing was Roger Waters. I mean,
oh man, that is so over the top. Yeah, let's talk about it. For those of you who don't know, Roger Waters was a member of one of the most successful rock bands in the world, Pink Floyd, and I liked Pink Floyd. Dark Side of the Moon was one of my favorite albums. However, he is a blatant anti-Semite. Laureen, pick up what he did in Germany.
Gross. He's done a lot of bad things at concerts in Germany. And a couple of cities tried to shut him down. And then he petitioned a court and he won. But at his latest concert, he literally shows up on stage pretty much wearing a Nazi SS uniform with swastikas on it and everything. And you know, then he's running like sort of like this movie clip, you know, with different names of victims, you know, as if somehow there's a moral equivalent among them. So he has
comparing them to the 6 million Jews that were killed in the Holocaust.
So he does put Anne Frank's name up on this scrolling list of names, but then he has, for instance, reporter Shireen Abdullah, who unfortunately it was an accidental death, but was present at a shootout and got killed. It wasn't intentional. It was like an accidental death. Reporters do die in the field from you know, especially
If you're embedded, and you're embedded, it's a dangerous thing. Something as a reporter, I never. Right.
But it wasn't the equivalent of the Holocaust and
murder
and. And everything, and like, you know, you just see these things. I mean, the man just, he has no moral bounds. I mean,
But fortunately, Germany's anti-Semitism czar just lambasted him and said, this is totally inappropriate.
I mean, they're trying to seek legal action against him again, you know, within Germany. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with that. I mean, I'm hoping they're going to shut him down, but you know, he still keeps packing concerts, and this one was in Berlin. The prior one was in Frankfurt. And I find that to be just so chilling and disturbing. And it's just, if you're still a Pink Floyd fan, like just burn your CDs, cut up your records if you still have them. If you downloaded his songs on your iTunes account, delete them, you know, just stop giving the man money.
Right, because it puts money in his pockets. That's right. He should be shunned. He should be chastised, and he should be a non-involved personality. But unfortunately, he's very popular and influences a lot of young people, which scares me. We'll get into something about young people and anti-Semitism a little bit later on in this show. We also ought to mention that this was Shavuos or Shavuot, depending whether you say the Ashkenazi way or the Sephardic way.
Right, right. So
So this
Torah
this
is, the Ashkenaz Shavuot, the Sephardi way of saying it, but it's one of the three Yom Tov holy days where all the men of Israel to go to the temple to bring an offering to Hashem. And so on this day in history, Shavuot, so we just celebrated it this past weekend. It was a sundown Thursday, which I think was May 25th. I mean, I can't, but Thursday night, you observe for 2 days here in the States. So through Saturday night, it was Shavuot. But on that day in history, God gave us the Torah. On that day in history, Shavuot is such an important history moment because it was when God appeared on Mount Sinai, and it says, there were shofar blasts and lightning and thunder, and like the whole world could see, the glory of Hashem, the glory of God come down, and that we as Jews could audibly hear his voice. And it says, and Moses is very clear, that it is if we, because he says, as if you and your seed, that means us, it's as if we, it's woven into our DNA, were there on that day. And so it's just this great time to really, thank God for Torah, right? Because Torah introduced to the world concepts of justice, concepts of mercy, concepts of righteousness. And so it's really this profound gift that God gave to the world, on that day on Shavuot. So a very important day that a lot of Jews here in America don't necessarily celebrate.
No, not at all. And in fact, I mentioned it to a couple of my friends who were Jewish. I said, oh, really? They're not aware. And it's a big dairy holiday, too.
Right, it's a big dairy holiday instead of our normal meat feast, but yeah. So it's a great time,
Well, okay. My understanding, Lorraine, is the reason it's such a dairy holiday is that when we received the Torah, all the meat that we had was not considered kosher, and there wasn't enough time to kosherize, kashrit the meat. So, am I correct in this? You know more about this than I do. And then so they just ate dairy instead of meat. Am I getting this right?
I have several stories. I mean, like there are a couple of different stories, why it's dairy. But go if you go to the Chabad website, they'll give you all the download. But there's multiple stories on why, but that's obviously one of them. Who knows? which story really rules wins at the end of the day. But
right.
The main tradition of the holiday is to study. So you stay up all night on the night of Shavuot and you would study Torah.
I know you're much more religious than I am. Did you stay up all night?
I did. I have a real hard time staying up all night. So
yeah, me too.
But I do enjoy just like having some quiet time to really study and enjoy. And again, I think as Jews, we don't read it enough. I mean, it's like, someone's reading the Torah, a shul, whatever. They say the piece in Hebrew. You don't really appreciate what's being said. But it is such a great, there's so many good nuggets of not only wisdom but the stories and just all kinds of great action. And it's just such a, it's, I love to like just stop and read. I mean, you just read a chapter and go, wow, like all that happened. And it really is. It's you always get something new out of it when you take the time to read it. But anyway, apart from that, so still going back to anti-Semitism, I want to say this, we've talked about Christiane Amanpour, like it's no secret she's anti-Semitic. We know it, she's always equating Israel and victims with terrorists. There's like, her moral equivalency. If you're a victim, you're a terrorist. So that horrible story about Rabbi
the family D, that was shot, the mother and the two daughters, right?
Yeah, Lucy D, Maya D, and Rina D, when they were driving for the Passover holiday, they were driving north in Israel, and they, terrorists ambushed their vehicle, and they were shot point blank, for the sole crime of being Jewish. I mean, they weren't armed. So Christiane Amanpour on, CNN says, they died in a shootout.
She did apologize and say, I misspoke.
She only after substantial.
Yeah, she got a lot of criticism, but listen, how many people
do
we know?
She wouldn't do it publicly. At first, she refused to do it publicly.
But then she did. What she said was stupid, was terrible. And I don't condone it, but so many people will never go back. At least she said, I misspoke. Yeah, that's sort of a win in our column.
Yeah, I mean, sort of a way. I mean, it's just, but it was part and
parcel. It never should have had her. She should never should have said it in the first place. Part
and parcel, but just the way she died. I mean, it's just who she is. I mean, you can listen to her any day of the week, and she'll say something like that, and you just, it's like, when is enough enough? Like, there's no repercussion for her. The producers of CNN don't stop her. Like, she could just say whatever she wants, and I think.
Well, CNN is having their own problems these days. They have really plummeted. To say the least, they are having their issues. You know what that struck me or jumped out is that Taylor Swift's boyfriend, her current boyfriend, Matt Healy, who I guess is a young person's personality. Does he do music? I don't know who he is. But anyway, he gave a Heil Hitler salute at a concert. He is blatantly anti-Semitic. The only good thing is Taylor Swift never stays with any guy for one long period, so we can expect to hear about him in a song.
Right. Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, I know.
It's bothersome. I don't understand how, you know, and I like Taylor Swift. I mean, who doesn't like Taylor Swift? She seems wholesome and nice. Could be with anybody that has such anti-Semitic views. But like I say, there's going to be a song about this guy coming up because they will break up.
I hope so. But on more serious news, Cooney, so the city.
Golly. This is terrible. I'm sorry. Cooney is the City University of New York. And their law school, which is so anti-Israeli based. Anyhow, they support BDS. They had a resolution, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that was passed a while ago. I mean, there's...
No, I know, no. I'm setting the stage for this. Yeah. Okay, now you explain what happened.
So at the City University of New York Law School, which has had countless complaints of anti-Semitism by Jewish students, which the university refuses to investigate and take seriously, to the point that the City Council of New York is, like, threatening to pull funding... because they
get public money. It's a public university, right?
They won't investigate. Like, they refuse to, like, treat these issues as serious. So for the commencement speech for the law school, they invited a speaker, Fatima Mohammed, who made these horrid, like, so here's one of countless paragraphs of what she said, quote, "This is the law school that passed and endorsed BDS on a student and faculty level, recognizing that absent a critical imperialism, settler, colonialism lens, our work in the school's mission statement is void of value as Israel continues to indiscriminately rain bullets and bombs on worshipers, murdering the old, the young, attacking the funerals and graveyards as it encourages lynch mobs." End quote. This was
her commencement speech to the law school. Her
keynote speaker. I mean, are you kidding me? It's just like when are they gonna finally do something? I don't understand. Like, how does Cooney?
And wasn't it sort of surreptitious that they didn't know she was gonna, or somebody, nobody was warned ahead that this was gonna be a speech such as that?
Oh my, come on. I mean, all you had to do is, like, I mean, they clearly knew who she was when they invited.
Oh yeah. No, I know, but I don't know. It was terrible. Did you go to your law school graduation?
I did.
Who spoke? You remember?
I have no clue.
I know who spoke at my graduation.
I have no clue. I graduated early. And there was only, like, for law school, I think there's only 20 of us who graduated early, and it was a small commencement. And we were so exhausted because we had just finished finals the day before that I think I probably slept through the graduation.
Walter Cronkite spoke at my graduation.
Oh, wow. Now that's impressive.
At the University of Missouri in 1970, after he had given his speech, "Mr. President, we can't win in Vietnam." And that was the year of Kent State, which happened just a couple of months before graduation. So it was a rousing speech by Walter Cronkite. It was just spectacular. Sort of off topic, but I just wondered. Okay, let's see. There are a lot of other things that I found interesting this week. I was happy to see that the jurors in the Tree of Life trial are having their identity kept shielded, because there's concern that they will be targets of anti-Semitism.
I think that was a very, I know there's always controversy when you're not publicly showing who the jurors are. But I again, like in a trial like that, I think, you know, when you know that these innocent people who are doing their service, their citizen duty to serve on a jury, and you know, like their lives can be in danger, I think it's important that you're protecting and shielding them. I think that's the most responsible.
Yeah, I mean, as a journalist, even who wants as much openness and transparency as possible, there is no question that that is a wise decision. You don't want them intimidated or hurt or be subjected to anti-Semitism. There's no question about it.
Right. So I had to bring something back up from last week because we were talking about George Soros. And I think it's really important because after the show, there was a piece that came out in the Wall Street Journal. And Amichai Shikli, who is the anti-Semitism czar for Israel, also released a statement, you know, going on this point. You know, I think, you know, what a lot of people don't know. So Human Rights Watch, Mike, you and I have talked about Human Rights Watch. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, the United Nations, HRW was the first, you know, quote unquote, human rights organization to release a massive 100 plus page report accusing Israel of apartheid. Now, again, that report was false. They redefined the word apartheid. And unless you took the time to actually read the report and dig into the footnotes and understand how apartheid doesn't mean what we all perceive it to mean from South Africa, you wouldn't know that. It was done for the purpose of being able to use that word, that inflammatory word, when you're talking about Israel, right? It was just an absolute smear campaign against the legitimacy of Israel. Now, George Soros, this is a perfect example. He funded the Human Rights Watch with $100 million.
Yeah, but okay, wait. I understand that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he had anything to do with the writing of the report. He gives money to all sorts of organizations.
Yeah, but he wrote a $100 million check when the new CEO came in and changed the Human Rights Watch into an organization that was singularly focused on the destruction and demonization of Israel. And he purposely said, like, this is Soros' words. I'm a very active participant with that group. Soros' words.
Soros, look, Laureen, no matter how you feel about him personally, Deborah Lipstadt, who is the anti-Semitism czar for the United States, Jonathan Greenblatt, who I know you don't like with the ADL, and several others have said that the George Soros trope, when you use George Soros, prosecutors, George Soros this, George Soros that, it is anti-Semitic. It's a trope. Rothschilds were used as those money-grubbing Jews.
George Soros is a disgusting, reprehensible Jew. He's a horrific human being. I think he's one of the most evil.
But it's used as an anti-Semitic trope.
No, it's not.
By the right wing, Laureen. It's mainly right wing people that say that.
Okay, hold on. It's not just right wing people that say that. I say that, and countless people want to legitimately criticize George Soros because George Soros, who's been funding by $2 billion.
You can criticize his politics and actions, but when you use it, especially a non-Jewish person talking about George Soros funded prosecutors, which he doesn't fund them. I'm talking about the trope. It is anti-Semitic. When someone says he's a George Soros based prosecutor, I go, that guy is anti-Semitic.
Hold on. Let's just stop there for a second. So George Soros is funded by $2 billion, and that number was actually several years. That's now several years old.
Wait, George Soros
has funded by $2 billion socialist leftist movements, not only here in the United States, but in Latin America and globally. And that includes, and it is factual that he does fund certain organizations that support far left prosecutors. So that is a fact. That's factual. So you should be able to point that out because there is not he's the largest donor. I mean, by far. And people need to be able to have that conversation.
You will never convince me that someone who it is anti-Semitic. It is anti-Semitic when Ron DeSantis says it. It's anti-Semitic says it.
I don't think Ron DeSantis isn't wrong. He's right, and I completely agree.
Oh, you think he's right when the federal court said that what he did was completely illegal with Andrew Warren, but the court didn't have the right to.
We're talking about George Soros, which is a different.
No, I know, but I'm talking about him as a George Soros based prosecutor. It's anti-Semitic, Lorene.
If not, to point that out, because George Soros represents the funding of the far-left socialist movement globally. That is what that means.
You and I are just going to have to disagree on that. Yeah,
no, hold on. But I want to make another point, because the other point that came out is Amichai Shikri, who is the anti-Semitism czar for Israel.
Extreme right-wing anti-Semitism czar who is going to Canada, and in Canada is considering allowing him in, because he's only meeting with right-wing people. He is so ultra right-wing. You're right. He says Soros is bad and he's doubled down. But this guy is a right-wing crazy.
So he is the anti-Semitism czar for
right-wing
Israel.
Anti-Semitism czar.
Who cares? Right-wing.
I care. Enough.
But in Israel, his responsibility is to protect the people, the Jewish people, the home state of Israel, the largest home of all the Jewish people on the face of the earth, Israel. And he said, quote, that there's not a single person that's done more to damage Israel's standing in the world, especially among so-called progressives, than George Soros, end quote. And that's a factual statement.
No, it's not factual. That's his opinion. Come on, Lorene, that's not factual. You would never stand up in court to say that is factual. Yeah, you're okay. An attorney, you know that that's an opinion. It's an opinion. Mike, it is not a fact. It's an opinion.
Mike, tell me one other person who has funded anti-Israel propaganda and caused more hatred against Israel, and not Hitler, don't give me that, and alive today that has caused more harm to Israel than George Soros. He's the number one funder of BDS. He's the number one funder of the apartheid.
No. He gives to organizations, some of the organizations he contributes to.
No, support. He's the largest funder of the predominant BDS movement organizations. He's the one who's been funding them for 2 decades. I mean, this is fact. Those are facts, Mike. So I think we need to have, we need to stop defending the man. I mean,
I'm not defending him. I'm defending the fact that it's used as an anti-Semitic trope. That's what I'm talking about. It's an anti-Semitic trope. But anyhow, you and I are never going to agree on this. You and I will never agree on this.
I think he is fair game. I say attack him all you want. He is fair game.
All right. Hey, let's make a left turn. Lorene and I were talking before the show that I'm concerned that some of the right-wing anti-Semitic people are grooming their kids to grow up to hate Jews. And maybe I'm being ultra paranoid in all of that, but I think it's a real threat that we have to keep our eyes on. And to sort of put it in perspective, I found a piece about the Hitler Youth that way before World War II started, that they started indoctrinating them to hate Jews and go on and on. And I think we need to be aware of the possibilities out there. So I wanted to listen to this piece. So let's take a listen.
Some of the most famous images of the Nazi period in Germany are from the many rallies that were thrown in support of the party, different organizations within it, and Hitler. The Nuremberg rallies that took place every September from the small rallies of the 1920s and early 30s to 1939, when the war in Europe began. After the Nazi seizure of power in 1933, the Nuremberg party rallies became huge events. And among the rally goers were members of the Hitler Jugend, the Hitler Youth, or HJ. The Hitler Youth were males between the age of 14 and 18. A large number of other rally attendees were members of Bund Deutsche Mädel, or the League of German Girls, or BDM. The BDM was made up of girls between the ages of 14 and 18. At the 1936 Nazi Party rally, over 900 BDM girls got pregnant, causing a national scandal. Many, not all, and perhaps not even most, but many of the girls had been pressured into sex, or forced into it, sometimes by members of the Hitler Youth, sometimes by much older men. The result? Most of the girls were made to have abortions, whether they wanted the procedure or not. Welcome to History on Fleek. Today we examine the untold underbelly of the Hitler Youth Movement. Those of you familiar with the hit 1972 movie and Broadway play Cabaret will recognize the title of this section of our video. In the Oscar-winning movie, there is a wholesome scene of German farmers and townspeople sitting at an outdoor tavern, drinking, laughing, and talking. Suddenly, a teenage boy gets up and starts singing an innocent-sounding song, which quiets the crowd. But as the song goes on, it's revealed that the singer and two of his friends are wearing the uniform of the Hitler Youth. And soon the song takes an ominous turn, and by the end, the entire crowd is giving Hitler salutes and singing the lines, "Tomorrow belongs to me." The Hitler Youth were not Boy Scouts, as much as some former members of the organization insist it was. Yes, many HJ events and activities were very much like those of the Boy Scouts. Camping, hiking, sing-alongs, swimming, skiing, learning woodcraft, and more. But they also spent much of their time marching, being taught basic military drill, and most insidious of all, the ideology of hatred that was Nazism. Behind all the innocent things the Hitler Youth did, there was ideological training, and the boys of the HJ learned three primary things. One, as Germans, they were members of the master race, or Herrenvolk, and superior to all others, especially the people the Nazis said were the arch enemy of all Germans, the Jews. Two, that as members of the master race, it was their destiny to rule the world. Three, that Adolf Hitler was to be obeyed without question, was the embodiment of Germany, and was the Messiah of the German people, here to lead them to a new golden age. Three rules for disaster. Shortly after taking power, Hitler delivered a famous quote talking about opponents of his movement, saying that they say, "I will not come over to your side." I calmly say, "Your child belongs to us already. What are you? You will pass on. Your descendants, however, now stand in the new camp. In a short time, they will know nothing else but this new community." To Hitler, the youth of Germany were the future of his movement and of Germany. In his vision, they needed to be taught only that which served the state and the party. The three most important features of Nazi education have already been mentioned, and to be honest, other than technical instruction, which evolved into weapons and tactics instruction, that's all there was to Nazi education. The themes of German ethnic superiority and the so-called evil nature of the Jews were what virtually every other lesson revolved around. Put simply, many of the members of the Hitler Youth were brainwashed, and those that weren't often bought into elements of Nazi thinking because they agreed with them to a degree, or because, like most young people, they did not want to stand out. The Hitler Youth and the BDM were the two biggest elements of the Nazi youth movement, and membership in them was obligatory. You had to join, though some people managed to evade it for a while or found ways to slack off. However, there were voluntary organizations for younger children. For girls aged 10 to 14, there was Jungmädelbund, the Young Girls League. For boys aged 10 to 14, the DJ, or DJV, for Deutsches Jungvolk in der Hitlerjugend. Most Nazi party members sent their younger children to meetings and activities of these organizations, and quite a number of non-party members did as well, hoping that membership in them would help their children, and perhaps their parents, get by better in the new Germany. Quite simply, the HJ and the BDM were limited to Germans of German descent. That makes sense, at least on the surface. However, there were other German citizens, many of whose families had been in Germany for centuries. These would be German Jewish children. In the first 2 years of the Nazi regime, the Jews were not the biggest target of the Nazis' hatred. Before they could deal with the Jews, the Nazis needed to secure their place at the top, and to do so, they had to get rid of more powerful enemies, the communists, the social democrats, the trade unions, and smaller groups of more liberal thinkers, such as many journalists, etc. In 1935, though, the Nazis passed the Nuremberg Laws, which put severe limits on the Jews of Germany and denied them entry into the cultural life of Germany. In other words, they were isolated from the rest of the country. Even before 1935, Jewish children began to feel isolated and threatened by what was going on in their country. And the people that most represented the Nazi movement to young people was the Hitlerjugend. In the years before World War II, the Hitler Youth terrorized the Jewish children of Germany. Jewish German survivors of the Holocaust and writings from the time describe daily beatings, bullying, name-calling, and humiliation at the hands of the Hitler Youth. For years, no Jewish child was safe on the street alone. And though there were times when Jewish boys would band together in what amounted to self-defense gangs, they were almost always outnumbered. And when the police got involved, they were always blamed for the trouble. The Hitler Youth were virtually untouchable when it came to the things they did to the Jewish kids of Germany before the war. One of the pillars of the Nazi state was the idea of the Führerprinzip, the principal leader. As you might imagine, this had much to do with Hitler being the head of the German state and the leader of the German people. But there was more to it than that. The Führerprinzip meant that at every level of society, there were leaders and followers. And it was the duty of every person to follow the orders of the leader ahead of them. In Nazi ideology, people, even Germans, were not created equal. Some were superior, and some inferior. A significant aspect of this idea was of das Blut, or the blood. The Nazis were fanatical believers that the blood carried the traits and culture of a race, and those traits shared by ancestors. This was the root of Nazi anti-Semitism. It did not call for hatred of the Jews because of religious differences, but because they genuinely believed that Jewish and many other people's blood was inferior. Of course, the Nazi idea of the blood went much further than the belief that people's actual blood was superior. It was a kind of early view on genetics and the idea that Germans carried superior traits from biology and evolution. This also meant that within German society, it was clear that those who truly believed in Hitler's vision of the world and who excelled in it must truly be superior, which meant their blood was superior, and therefore their children, for the most part, would be superior too. This meant that the gifted youth of Germany had to be specially educated, for they were what Hitler thought as the vanguard of the future. Most of these gifted youth, but not all, were from the families of party members and higher Nazi party officials. Many of them were the sons of the Golden Pheasants, a derogatory nickname for the regional leaders of Germany, or Gauleiters, who wore brownish gold uniforms and strutted about like they were God's gift. Imagine the arrogance of their children. From a young age, they were taught that they were superior beings, above all others on the planet, as both individuals and as part of the German nation. At the NAPOLAS, the Nationalpolitische Lehranstalt, or National Political Teaching Institute, sons of the Nazi elite learned about Nazi ideology and governance, for they were seen as the inheritors of the Nazi state. Many of these boys and young men were hated, even by many other members of the Hitler Youth, for their place in society and their attitude of superiority towards other Germans. Had the 1936 party rally scandal in Nuremberg happened during the war, it's likely most of those pregnant girls and young women would not have been coerced into having an abortion, but would probably have been pressured to having the child. In 1936, the Nazis had only been in power for 3 years and were still very sensitive to public opinion. The public opinion was against girls getting pregnant and young women getting pregnant when single. By 1942, this attitude had changed, at least for those in the party making the rules and setting the tone for society. By this time, Nazi ideology had been teaching that motherhood and the home were women's natural place for years. Also, by 1942, German casualties were piling up, and boys grew up to be soldiers. Though in 1942, many hardcore Nazis didn't quite understand that their days were numbered. Women were taught cooking, sewing, child-rearing, and myths about the role of women in German history. They were also taught the basics of Nazi ideology to pass that knowledge on to their youngsters before they even went to school. One last thing about the BDM, the Hitler Youth and parents, in yet another gross abuse of power, the Nazis encouraged the boys and girls of Germany to keep an eye on their parents for any sign that they were anti-Nazi, anti-Hitler, defeatist, or critical of the Nazi policies against the Jews, or, worse yet, helping Jews to avoid persecution and deportation to the East, as the Nazis called their transport to the extermination camps in Poland. Alfons Heck, a Hitler Youth member who received a medal for bravery in battle from the hands of Hitler towards the end of the war, called the experience of the Hitler Youth the biggest case of child abuse in world history. He may have been right.
I find it frightening, Lorene. I find it frightening, and I'm concerned about these kids who are the children of the people that hate Jews. Well, am I being paranoid, you think?
Right? Yeah. I mean, when you think about, like, look, we've looked at some of these Pew studies, even in the current generation, right, and Generation Z, and Generation X, that, you know, XYZ, like the millennials, and then the Generation Z, the Gen Zers.
Yeah, I'm a baby boomer. I don't know anything past that.
I mean, Alpha is the next generation, the younger kids were born, I think, after 2010. But the millennials and Gen Zers, you know, we've looked at those Pew studies we talked about on the show, where most of them, you know, even though they seem to have a strong views on racism and different things, when it comes to Jews and anti-Semitism, they don't see anti-Semitism as a problem. They don't think Jews suffer anti-Semitic attacks. They don't think Jews need to be protected. And it's just like, well, wait a second, where did you, like, when we know factually that Jews, you know, are the target of, like, you know, over 50% of the religious hate crimes and our hate targets, and we've seen the skyrocket rise in anti-Semitic incidents across the nation. You know, it's like, where are they learning this from?
And I know it scares me.
The board. I mean, that's not just like, you know, these crazy, you know, Nazi people who are raising their children to you know, hate all Jews. I mean, this is like across the board, and it's like this. It's a very weird circumstance.
It is. But Lorene, we got to take a break because we got a big interview coming up next with Ken Marcus, who is with the Brandeis Center, about the president's effort to fight anti-Semitism. We will do that right after this. This is The Third Opinion. That interview in just a moment. But have you looked at our webpage, where you can listen to previous editions of The Third Opinion podcast, find out more about our hosts, and leave a comment or two? And now, back to The Third Opinion podcast and that interview. Welcome back to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. On WKDW and the podcast, I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
All right, Lorene, set up Ken Marcus. And I will disagree with some of what he said. He said some good things, but I'll disagree. Go ahead, set him up.
No. So we all know that President Biden this week announced his comprehensive plan to counter anti-Semitism. I mean, look, I have some very strong issues with it. And I don't think it's any different than what I'm hearing from other groups. I mean, Jonathan Greenblatt and the AJC, a week before the plan was released, they all took to Twitter and social media to push for the adoption of the International Holocaust Remembrance Association's definition of anti-Semitism as the sole definition. This was a huge push by those organizations and others, including StopAntiSemitism.org, et cetera, the Brandeis Center. Why? You know, well, Kenneth Marcus is going to explain that, because some of the other definitions that Jew haters were promoting, like the nexus definition, do not provide the same protection and scope to fight anti-Semitism, and allows attacks, you know, like, you know, accusing Israel of being an apartheid and attacking students related to that, you know, it allows that to be seen as not being anti-Semitic. And that's a big concern. You know, I would also mention, Mike, I think it's important that we should note that the Latin American Parliament last week also in full adopted the IHRA definition, and the European Congress has already adopted that definition.
Let's listen to Marcus, and then I'll say something.
We should note America did not adopt it alone. Instead, we adopted that definition along with nexus.
Okay, so here's Marcus.
We don't need government to do that.
All right, we here's Marcus.
And then I will start with the pros, because I do think it is notable that for the first time we now have a national strategy on combating anti-Semitism. And I think that President Biden and his team deserve credit for having brought together agencies across the entire federal government with the purpose of asking how we can most effectively deal with anti-Semitism in America. Now, there's reason why he's done it. Anti-Semitism, a lot of people think that anti-Semitism soared under President Trump. They're not wrong about that. But the increase under President Biden has been much greater. Under his watch, under President Biden's watch, we have had historic levels of hatred against Jews, as well as extraordinary violent attacks on Jews and extraordinary problems on college campus. So we need it, but he has indeed brought together government officials. And while the product might not be as strong as what we would like, it does send a useful signal across the country, including to those people, especially on the progressive side, who have been in denial of anti-Semitism, who think it doesn't exist, who thinks that a diversity, equity, and inclusion problem should not include Jews, and instead that Jews should simply own their privilege. This is a useful message from the federal government of the United States saying to all of America that anti-Semitism is a serious problem and we need to deal with it. I think we should give President Biden credit for doing that. It is not the first national anti-Semitism strategy in the world. The European Union established a national strategy on anti-Semitism 2 years ago. It was a much stronger strategy. The Biden strategy, despite all of the accolades he's getting, really doesn't have the substance that we're hoping for. But we should at least start by saying it's good that it is out there. It is good that we have a strategy, and better than not having anything at all.
You know, and I think, by the way, I want to let people know, Ken, that you do have a couple op-ed pieces that were out this past week, including with the Jewish Journal, the Washington Examiner, and the New York Times. So to the extent we don't have opportunity to sort of do more of a deep dive into some of these issues today, people can go and look at that. But let's talk about why there's, you know, what's the fluff? You know, before we get into some of the cons, which obviously the IHRA issue is a huge, you know, disappointment, but what's some of the other fluff around this that doesn't really have the bite that, for instance, the European plan has?
Yeah. So they're almost the same size. The European plan was 59 pages. This plan is 60 pages. But this 60 pages really has a whole lot of nothing for many of the pages. So I'll give you some examples. There are some ideas about Holocaust education that should have been done out of the Holocaust Memorial Museum. And you read that and you say, well, that sounds like it's a good idea. But the fact is that the Holocaust Memorial Museum was already planning to do that. So it's not a new idea. It's just something that was already going to happen. And so the White House wants to take credit for it. The EEOC already made a statement on anti-Semitism, and they just want to take credit for it. One of the ideas in the plan is for my former agency, the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, or OCR, to collect data on religious discrimination. Well, that's something that we urged the Obama administration to do, and they said yes, and they started doing it. And then when I was in the Trump administration, we expanded on that, providing more detail on it. Biden isn't actually saying we should do something new here. He's not even expanding on Trump. This is the first administration not to expand on it. He's just not doing away with it. And so the idea of collecting that data, even though it's an old idea, that's included. One of the ideas is that professional sports leagues should raise awareness of anti-Semitism, and there's some detail there. Well, it's not a bad idea for professional sports leagues to raise awareness about anti-Semitism. But in the United States, all major professional sports leagues joined the National Shine a Light Initiative in December, and they've all been doing this. Now, maybe they've not all been doing each of the things that Biden wants them to do, but he's essentially telling these leagues to do something that they've been doing for the last 6 months anyhow. And at any rate, what does that have to do with the federal government? It's private groups. So there's lots of this stuff here. There are lots of ideas that either are already happening or have nothing to do with the federal government. It's just as if the White House went to all of the agencies and said, tell us everything you're doing that's good for the Jews, and we'll stick it together in a plan. And if you're not doing it, tell us about what other people are doing or other organizations, and we'll put it in a plan and make it look like it's something new from this White House and take credit for it afterwards. It's not unusual for presidential administrations to put this sort of fluff in. But when we look at what appears to be a comprehensive plan, because it's 60 pages long, we should understand that a lot of it is really not new, not original, not creative, and as you put it, fluff.
Right. And I think that's sort of the frustration, right? I mean, at the initial reaction, when people look at it, they're like, oh, wow, look what the administration is doing. This is awesome. But at the same time, you're like, well, hold on. You know, let's back up and take a more critical look at this. And are they really implementing something new and something that's going to be beneficial? And I think for me, when I look at the IHRA definition, this is the most alarming, right? When I see Jew haters and Israel's enemies celebrating on social media, from CARE to Palestine Legal and so many others, countless Jew-hating organizations celebrating the fact that the Biden administration did not adopt the definition of the IHRA, but instead included this watered-down version with what is called quote, the Nexus document, end quote, it should raise serious red flags across the Jewish world. I think a lot of people are not aware of this Nexus document. They don't understand it. So can you help the audience, including myself, understand sort of what the Nexus document is and how it's actually going to impact the implementation of what would have otherwise been the strong implementation of the IHRA definition?
Yeah, a lot of us were warning the Biden White House that if they really wanted to have a good plan, they need to base it on the IHRA working definition, because that's really the one definition that makes it clear that sometimes anti-Zionism crosses a line and becomes anti-Semitism. And that definition has been used for years. It was used during the Bush administration. It was adopted in a formal way during the Obama administration. It was not only adopted, but given real strength and teeth through an executive order by the Trump administration and signed by President Donald Trump. This new document embraces the IHRA working definition. It had already been adopted by prior administrations. It's still adopted. But the use of the IHRA working definition, not only was it not given detail, not only was there a real conspicuous silence about how it should be used, for instance, to deal with campus anti-Semitism, a kind of a deafening silence. But the Biden administration made, I think, the real mistake of giving nearly equal base for a definition of anti-Semitism that very few people had ever even heard of. It's called the Nexus document. It's somewhat controversial among the few people who had heard of it. It was not an internationally agreed upon definition like IHRA. It's a definition that was put together at the University of Southern California by a handful of left-wing academics and activists and former government officials on the progressive side, relatively small number of people, who were developing kind of an alternative to IHRA that makes it easier for people, especially on the left, to get away with using anti-Zionism that crosses the line into anti-Semitism unless they engage in physical violence. So there are lots of different ways of marginalizing and excluding and harassing Jewish Americans, including Jewish college students, that would not be defined as anti-Semitic under the Nexus document. That includes using double standards against Israel, for instance. Or lots of BDS activity would not be considered anti-Semitic. And in fact, that's the point of the Nexus definition, to give a kind of a get out of jail free card to people who are engaged in anti-Zionist forms of anti-Semitism. I don't think that the Biden strategy as a whole is consistent with the Nexus document. I think much of what's in the plan is a lot closer to IHRA. But it really was a massive mistake to include Nexus. And instead of being a step forward, keep in mind that President Biden actually claims that he was motivated to run for president because he was so disgusted with the anti-Semitism that he saw during the Charlottesville Unite the Right march. So he's someone who actually says that he was motivated to run for president because of anti-Semitism. And here he is in the big plan. And not only is he not pushing the ball forward, but he's actually using a definition of anti-Semitism that will weaken our approach to anti-Semitism. That's just very, very disappointing.
It is. And I think it's a really important point. You know, when I think about the confusion and the opportunity it's going to create for Jew haters, for instance, on college campuses, you mentioned BDS, the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, Students for Justice of Palestine, who propagate that movement on college campuses, you know, with our apartheid week, apartheid wall, you know, even the professor, for instance, that we saw at George Washington University that Mike and I have been talking about on the show, who, you know, has been openly attacking Jewish students in her DEI course. You know, all these things give the universities and give these organizations and these Jew haters cover. Because, oh, well, I'm not anti-Semitic. I'm just attacking what the evil state of Israel has done, because Israel is engaging in these heinous crimes of ethnic cleansing or apartheid or whatever else it, you know, the lie of the day might be. And it's and so to the extent that these Jewish students are feeling discriminated against, retaliated against, unsafe, you know, it's certainly, you know, I like you to sort of talk about that because I'm a little concerned, right? You and I, before we went on the air, I shared a story. My son, he's a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University. You know, several weeks ago around Passover, all over campus, there were posters that were put up saying Israel is an apartheid state with a QR code. And if you scan that QR code, it took you immediately to the Amnesty International report, which Amnesty Britain accused Israel of being apartheid. Of course, unless you're going to spend the time to actually read the report, research it, and understand it, you will have no idea that Amnesty completely rewrote the definition of apartheid, that Amnesty, you know, just the whole thing was just an anti-Semitic Jew hatred attack that is baseless in fact and reality. But these college kids probably aren't going to do that, you know. And now you have an unsafe space. And now you have students, because they're pro-Israel, being attacked because they support Israel. But that's not anti-Semitism. That's anti-Zionism. I think the concern is, how is this going to play out? Like, what do we think it's going to look like now with the DOE or others when students are trying to file complaints? I mean, I know a lot of it right now is just sort of speculation, but obviously it creates this confusion. And it doesn't help the cause in defending these kids. So you know, what can we expect going forward?
So, Lorraine, confusion is a good word. And the reason for the confusion isn't that the report is all bad. It's that it has such a mix. I'll give you an example, a couple more good things. The report does repeatedly refer to our own Louis D. Brandeis Center case against the University of Vermont that was successfully resolved just a month ago. Now, that case significantly involves very strong forms of anti-Zionism, including a teaching assistant who bragged on social media about lowering grades for Zionists. Now, so here was a case in which, for the first time, this administration, in the context of campus anti-Semitism, is identifying that this sort of thing creates a civil rights concern and force the university to make a significant number of changes. The White House isn't running away from that case. It's actually highlighting it. And it does have, throughout the report, in various parts, language indicating that discrimination against Israel can become anti-Semitic, and that Jewish students are facing intolerable discrimination based on the Zionist aspect of their identity. There's also a very clear message that Jewish students are protected under Title VI against discrimination based on their ethnic or ancestral background. So lots of good material that can use us that we can use for our purposes in protecting Jewish students. And this is sending a positive message to college administrators. So, for instance, the new article in Inside Higher Education, based on the national strategy, emphasizes that this shows that OCR is watching if there are anti-Semitic incidents. So this does send a positive message. On the other hand, it is unlikely that the Vermont case would have turned out the way it did if OCR had used the Nexus document. It is unlikely that it would have turned out as it did if the Department of Education had ignored IRA. So yes, it is disturbing that the Biden administration had sent such a mixed message, and it could possibly send a confusion throughout higher education, who might believe that they no longer have to follow IRA.
Now, here is the thing again, Lorraine. Most of the criticism comes from the right wing. So many groups have praised the president on May 25th, which was Thursday. This was the news release put out. In an era of rising anti-Semitism in the United States and around the world, we appreciate the clarity and urgency demonstrated by the White House in releasing its national strategy counter anti-Semitism signed by the Conference of the Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, ADL, AEPI, American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, American Jewish Committee, American Jewish Congress, American Sephardi Federation, on and on and on.
But do you also know that many of those organizations at the same time, Mike, and you can go read the news articles.
I know,
but many of them also released statements saying that they were critical of, they were very concerned about the fact that we are the first government to adopt the nexus definition. So, by the way, really important, how do you know that's a problem? I don't know. When CARE, when Palestine Legal, when Israel's enemies, when Jew haters applaud that the fact that America did not just adopt the IHR.
Let me go on. B'nai B'rith, Camera, Amuna of America, Greater Miami Jewish Federation, Hadassah,
I know,
Mike, Jesus,
but if you did,
they all praise the president.
Okay,
let's
give him a pat on the back. Mike, it's not right wing. That's a stupid statement.
Most of the criticism comes from the right wing, ma'am.
It's not right wing, Mike.
It's because the right wing hates Biden.
So stop antisemitism.org. No, it's not. The ADL and everybody said how crucial it was. And if you go to deeper comments, post the release, stopantisemitism.org, and all these other organizations continue to say, however, there is the asterisk. We have concerns that includes the nexus definition instead of just having the IHR.
It's a start, Lorene, but
he actually was very complimentary to the president, but also took issue because
he did. I will agree.
And he called out the number one problem, which is the same exact problem that the AJC, the ADL, StopAntisemitism.org, the Conference of American Presidents, etc., all raised issue with it up to the week of its release. You know, what are we going to do now?
It's May 25th that was put out. That was 2 days
ago from
the day
we taped
it. All
I have to do is look at that whole week. I could see every single one of them saying, please only do the IHRA.
Out and they released this press release, Lorene. Okay. This is the most current thing.
No, Mike, even after that press release, since May 25th, there are plenty of comments from Conference of American Jewish Presidents and many others saying, we have a concern.
I'm reading from the press release, Lorene.
Mike, I'm reading from the press releases. I'm reading the articles. I'm reading the quotes.
I just read it to you on the air.
Mike, would you like me to now pull up the articles that I sent you?
Because
these are all from May 25th. This is a real issue. We are the only government in the world that said, we're not just going to take the IHRA. We're going to add the nexus definition as well. It's a definition that CARE wants. Because CARE is opposed.
So why would those organizations praise the deal?
They don't praise the deal, Mike. They're like, they're.
Wait a second. What did I just read to you?
Mike,
wait a second. In an era of rising anti-Semitism in the United States and around the world, we appreciate the clarity and the urgency.
We appreciate. We appreciate. However, we still have an issue that you included the nexus definition, which waters down. I mean, here's
John. It's not in that press release.
John Greenblatt's exact words. It waters down. Like, this is, it has to be that definition, and we didn't do it, and we
Lorene,
know the consequences.
We can talk about this more, but we are out of time. That's what that music says. Maybe we'll pick it up next week. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. This is the Third Opinion. Two Jews, three opinions. Maybe sometimes even more. I'm Mike Deason.
Martin Jaffe.
Bye. That's our show for this week. Hope you'll join us again next week. And don't forget, subscribe to the Third Opinion Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.